I want you to picture a scenario for a second. Just really put yourself in this room.
Okay.
You are sitting in a doctor's office, and not just for a routine checkup, you've been dealing with chronic debilitating pain for months.
Oh, wow. That's the worst.
Right, the kind of pain that just like alters your personality, ruins your sleep, and just completely drains the color out of your life.
Yeah, absolutely exhausting.
Exactly. You are exhausted. You're sitting on that crinkly paper on the exam table, just desperate for relief. And finally, the doctor walks in.
Okay, the moment of truth.
Right. They sit down, they look over your chart, and they hand you a prescription bottle. But before you can even feel that wave of relief, that light at the end of the tunnel, they look you dead in the eye and say something completely unhinged.
Unhinged, how?
They say, "I need you to know something about what I just handed you. This is literally just a sugar pill. There is absolutely zero medicine in it. None. It has no biologically active ingredients whatsoever."
I mean, it sounds like a prank or a very bizarre psychological test or something.
Right. It feels completely insulting. I mean, if I'm sitting there in absolute agony and a medical professional hands me a Tic Tac and tells me it's a Tic Tac, my first instinct is to just, ask for a different doctor.
Yeah, he'd probably walk right out.
Totally. But here is the question we are exploring today. Would you take it? And more importantly, if you did take it, knowing with absolute certainty that it was completely inert, could that biologically useless little sugar pill actually cure your chronic pain?
Well, our entire modern framework of medicine screams that the answer is no. I mean, we are so deeply conditioned to believe that healing comes strictly from a chemical compound.
Right, like a drug.
Exactly, from active ingredients synthesized in a laboratory that targets, specific receptors in the body. So the very premise that knowing you were taking a fake pill could still heal you, it feels like it defies the laws of physics.
It feels like a scam, honestly. It feels like total snake oil. But today, we are looking at a stack of sources that proves it is decidedly not a scam.
No, it's very real.
Yeah. In fact, what we are going to talk about today might be one of the most profound medical discoveries of the 21st century. Today's deep dive is centered on a fascinating 2026 paper by C.F. Dietz.
It's an incredible piece of work.
It really is. It's titled The Grammar of Ritual: Ted Kaptchuk's Placebo Research and the Closure Framework. And let me tell you, reading through this research completely shattered the lens through which I view healthcare.
It is a heavy, dense paper, but the implications are just staggering. What Dietz is doing here is synthesizing 30 years, I mean, 3 whole decades of rigorous, peer-reviewed clinical research.
Right, from Harvard.
Yes, conducted at Harvard Medical School by a researcher named Ted Kaptchuk. Kaptchuk has essentially dedicated his entire career to taking a sledgehammer to everything we thought we knew about the placebo effect.
Which is wild.
It is. And Dietz steps in to provide a structural, philosophical framework for why Kaptchuk's seemingly impossible findings actually work in the real world.
And that is the mission for our deep dive today. We are going to break down how the ritual of going to the doctor, the waiting room, the stethoscope, the white coat, the tone of the doctor's voice might actually be the primary medicine you're receiving.
Not the drug itself.
Right. We aren't talking about the drug. We are talking about the experience of the clinic itself. So whether you are a medical professional, someone navigating your own chronic symptoms, or just a listener who is insanely curious about how the human mind and body interact, this information is going to permanently change how you view your next doctor's appointment.
You really will never look at a prescription pad the same way again.
Okay, let's unpack this.
To really grasp how revolutionary this framework is, we have to start where C.F. Dietz starts the paper, which is with what they call an impossible study.
An impossible study. I love that phrasing.
Right. This was conducted by Ted Kaptchuk back in 2010. And when I say impossible, I mean that according to the prevailing medical dogma of that era, the results of this study simply could not happen.
It broke all the rules.
Exactly. If the current rules of medicine were true, this study should have been a complete total failure.
Okay, let's set the stage for this. This is the irritable bowel syndrome study. And just to ground this in reality, because, sometimes medical terms can sound a bit sterile, the paper defines irritable bowel syndrome, or IBS, exactly as it presents in millions of people.
Right, it's not a minor thing.
No, it is a chronic condition characterized by severe abdominal pain, persistent bloating, and disordered bowel function. I think it's important to pause and recognize that we aren't talking about a mild stomach ache after eating too much spicy food.
Not at all.
IBS is a life-altering chronic condition. People plan their entire days around where the nearest bathroom is. It causes immense suffering and anxiety.
It's a highly distressing condition. And historically, it can be very difficult to treat effectively with standard pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, it's stubborn.
Very stubborn. It's one of those conditions that deeply affects a patient's quality of life, but often resists a simple chemical fix. So in 2010, Kapchuk and his team at Harvard Medical School recruit 80 patients who are suffering from severe IBS.
Okay, 80 patients.
Right. They divide these patients randomly into two groups. The first group is the control group. They receive no treatment at all. They're just monitored.
Pretty standard for a trial.
Yep. But the second group is where things get completely wild. They receive what Kapchuk termed open-label placebo.
Open-label, meaning like there is no trickery, all the cards are completely on the table.
Precisely. The clinicians handed these patients a bottle of pills. The bottles were clearly printed with labels that said placebo pills.
Wow.
Yeah, and the doctor sat down, looked the patients in the eye, and explained honestly and transparently that these pills were completely inert sugar pills. They contained absolutely no active pharmaceutical ingredients whatsoever.
But, and this is the crucial twist that Dietz points out in the text, and I want to make sure we don't breeze past this. The doctors didn't just hand them a bottle and say, here is some useless sugar, good luck, see you in a month.
No, that would ruin it.
Right. They provided a very specific context for the patients. They told the patients that rigorous clinical research showed that the human body could still heal itself in response to the ritual of taking medicine.
That is the key right there.
So they were completely honest that it was a placebo, but they were also honest that placebos have a proven track record of working.
That framing is vital. They were instructing the patients to engage in the act of taking the pill as a therapeutic ritual.
So it's an action, a performance almost.
Exactly. The patients were told to take the pills at a regular, specific time each day. They were physically engaging in the ceremony of being a patient who is actively receiving care.
What?
Now, if we look at this through the traditional medical model, this should do absolutely nothing. If you know a pill is fake, your brain shouldn't be tricked into healing your inflamed gut.
Mm-hmm.
The jig is up, so to speak.
Right, because my conscious brain is saying, I am eating sugar right now.
Yeah.
There is no chemical entering my bloodstream to reduce inflammation or, you know, calm my digestive tract.
Exactly.
But the results of this study, I have to admit, when I read this part of the source material, I had to stop and read it a second time.
It's hard to believe.
It really is. The patients in the open-label placebo group, the ones taking the self-admitted sugar pills, improved significantly more than the no-treatment group. And Dietz emphasizes this in the paper. It wasn't just a slight margin of error statistical bump. They improved significantly on validated objective symptom scales.
The effect sizes were astonishing. They were comparable to the effect achieved by the best available actual medications for IBS on the market at that time.
That is insane.
Let that really sink in for a moment. A sugar pill, knowingly taken as a sugar pill, rivaled the efficacy of targeted, synthesized pharmaceuticals.
I was just trying to wrap my head around how this is even possible, and the only way it makes sense to me is to think about it like watching a horror movie.
Oh, that's an interesting way to look at it.
Yeah, imagine you go to the theater, you buy your popcorn, you sit down, the lights go out, and you look up at the screen, you know, logically and consciously, that the monster on the screen is just CGI.
Sure.
You know, it's just actors in makeup reading a script on a soundstage in Hollywood. But when the monster jumps out of the closet, your heart still races, your palms still sweat. Your pupils dilate.
Your body reacts.
Exactly. Your biology is reacting to the setup, to the environment, to the ritual of being in a scary movie, completely ignoring the reality that there is no actual threat in the room with you. The conscious mind knows it's fake, but the body reacts anyway.
That analogy captures the mechanism perfectly. Your conscious awareness of the fake nature of the stimulus does not override your nervous system's deeply ingrained response to the environmental cues.
So it bypasses the logic entirely.
Right. Your body is experiencing the narrative of the horror movie as a physical reality. Kapchuk's study demonstrated that the body's healing response works in a very similar way.
Which is just mind-blowing.
It is. The conscious mind might say, this is sugar. But the nervous system is saying, we are engaging in a medical ritual. It's time to initiate healing. This single study fundamentally broke the prevailing medical theory of the time regarding placebos.
Because the old theory was entirely based on trickery.
Yes. For decades, the foundational belief in medicine was that placebos required deception to work. The assumption was that you had to trick the patient into holding a false belief.
Like, I believe this is a real drug.
Exactly. The logic went like this. I falsely believe this pill has medicine in it, therefore I expect to get better, therefore my brain reduces my symptoms. If you remove the deception, the entire house of cards was supposed to collapse.
But it didn't?
No, it didn't. Kapchuk showed that the house of cards isn't made of cards at all. It's made of steel. The healing happened without the false belief.
Okay, but let me put my skeptic hat on for a second. If I'm a researcher reading this in 2010, I'm looking at the study and thinking, all right, that's one study. Maybe there was a flaw in the methodology.
Of course. That's good science.
Right. Maybe IBS is just a weird, highly suggestible condition because the gut is so tied to stress. Maybe it's just a fluke. How do we know this wasn't just a strange anomaly isolated to 80 people in Boston?
That is the exact criticism the medical establishment threw at Kapchuk. To answer that, CFDs takes us back into the history of where this deception theory came from in the first place and how Kapchuk systematically went about dismantling it.
Okay, lay it on me.
The idea that placebos require deception really took hold with a landmark paper published in 1955 by a researcher named Henry Beecher. Beecher established the classic theory that placebos only work if the patient doesn't detect them as placebos.
So Beecher basically established the rule that the moment the magician shows you how the trick is done, the magic disappears.
That's a very good way to frame it. Beecher's work cemented this idea in modern medicine that placebo effects are fragile things. They are dependent entirely on the patient's ignorance.
Which makes sense on the surface.
Right. So when Kapchuk's 2010 IBS study came out, the burden of proof was entirely on him to prove it wasn't a fluke. And according to the source text, he didn't just replicate the study once to prove his point.
He kept going.
Oh, he kept going. Over the following years, he and his team replicated these open-label placebo findings across multiple, severe, highly diverse conditions.
And the list of conditions in the paper is staggering. We are not just talking about minor ailments or things that might naturally clear up in a few days.
No, not at all.
Kapchuk replicated this with cancer-related fatigue. I mean, imagine going through harsh oncology treatments, being utterly exhausted to your bones, and finding significant, measurable relief from taking an open-label sugar pill.
It's incredible.
He replicated it with chronic low back pain, which is notoriously difficult to treat. He replicated it with menopausal hot flashes. He even replicated it with opioid use disorder.
Yeah, that one is huge.
Right. These are incredibly complex, deeply physiological, often intractable conditions.
And in some of these subsequent studies, the findings were even more shocking to the medical community. The research showed that honest, open-label placebos were sometimes just as effective as deceptive placebos.
Wait, really? Just as effective?
Yes. The patients who knew they were getting sugar did just as well as the patients who were lied to and told they were getting real, active medicine.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because this forces a massive, unavoidable logical conclusion. If telling the truth doesn't destroy the placebo effect, then the false belief hypothesis is completely dead in the water.
It's gone.
Right, it is fully falsified. The mind isn't being tricked into healing the body. There is no magic trick happening at all, which means something else entirely must be doing the heavy lifting.
In science, when a long-standing hypothesis is falsified, you can't just throw your hands up. You have to look for a new mechanism.
Right. You have to figure out the why.
Exactly. If conscious expectation and false belief aren't the trigger for this profound biological reorganization, then what is the trigger? Kapchuk realized that the healing effect couldn't be located in the patient's conscious thoughts about the pill itself. It had to be located somewhere in the structure of the experience.
Like the overall vibe of being there?
Yes, the ritual, yes. The ceremony of care.
But wait, how does a ritual actually trigger a biological response if we aren't consciously thinking about it? If conscious expectation isn't the trigger, are you saying the body is reacting to subconscious cues?
That's exactly it.
Like, is my body picking up on things in the doctor's office that my conscious brain isn't even bothering to register?
That is the pivotal question. And it led Kapchuk into some of the most cutting-edge work of his career. To figure out if the body was responding to subconscious cues, he collaborated with researchers using fMRI technology, functional magnetic resonance imaging.
Okay, bringing in the big brain scanners.
Right. They wanted to look directly at what was happening in the brain in real time. The goal was to see if the placebo response could be triggered entirely below the threshold of conscious awareness.
Okay, the fMRI studies. This part of Dietz's paper honestly read like science fiction to me. Walk us through how they set this up.
They designed an experiment where patients were placed inside an fMRI scanner. For those who haven't been in one, it's a large tube-like machine that uses powerful magnets to track blood flow in the brain.
Very claustrophobic.
Oh, extremely. But it allows researchers to see which areas of the brain are active at any given moment. While the patients were inside the scanner, the researchers flashed images on a screen in front of them.
What kind of images?
These images were specifically chosen because they were associated with healing contexts. Things like medical symbols, clinical settings, or even cues that these specific patients had previously learned to associate with pain relief.
Okay, makes sense.
But here is the critical part of the experiment. They flashed these images for intervals that were too brief for the conscious mind to recognize.
We're talking milliseconds, literally faster than the blink of an eye, subliminal messaging speeds.
Yes. The conscious brain never registered seeing a doctor's office or a medical symbol. If you asked the patient immediately afterward, what did you just see on the screen?
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't be able to tell you.
They'd just be confused.
Right. They might just say they saw a flash of light. Mm-hmm. But the fMRI scans showed something incredible happening inside their heads. The placebo response, the activation of the brain's specific pain relief and regulatory networks, was triggered anyway.
Without them even knowing what they saw.
Exactly. The brain lit up as if it were actively receiving a medical treatment.
Hold on, let me make sure I'm wrapping my head around this. Are you telling me that we are basically like Pavlov's dogs?
Basically, yes.
But instead of a bell ringing and making us salivate for food, a flash picture of a stethoscope makes our brain release painkillers. Because that sounds ridiculous.
What's fascinating here is that your Pavlov analogy, as ridiculous as it might sound, is remarkably accurate. This study proves that the grammar of healing operates primarily at the level of learned neural patterns, not conscious cognition.
Learned neural patterns.
Think about it. Over the course of your entire life, your nervous system has been learning. It has learned to associate certain sensory cues, the sharp smell of rubbing alcohol, the visual of a crisp white coat, the sound of a blood pressure cuff inflating, the specific calming cadence of a doctor's voice with the biological states of healing and recovery.
So because I've been going to the doctor since I was a toddler getting a scraped knee bandaged by a nurse, my nervous system has literally been trained that these specific environmental cues mean help has arrived, the threat is over, it's time to start the healing process.
Exactly. Your nervous system has internalized these associations as an embodied grammar.
An embodied grammar.
When those sensory cues are presented in your environment, even subliminally, they activate that grammar. And that activation tells your biology to initiate a healing response.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to consciously believe in a pill. Your nervous system just needs to recognize the environmental cues that say, we are in a healing context now.
That is profound. It implies that our bodies are constantly reading the environment for permission to heal.
They absolutely are.
But it also raises a huge question. If a subliminal millisecond flash of an image on a screen is powerful enough to trigger a neurochemical cascade in the brain, what happens when you are fully immersed in a real-life medical environment?
Oh, it magnifies it.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, what happens when you aren't just looking at a screen in a tube, but you are sitting in a room having a dynamic interaction with another living, breathing human being?
That brings us to the next major phase of Kapchuk's research, and perhaps the most important one for day-to-day medical practice. If the ritual is the active ingredient, then the person conducting the ritual, the medical practitioner, must be central to the efficacy of the treatment.
The doctor is the active ingredient.
Exactly. To study this variable, Kapchuk's team designed experiments using sham acupuncture.
Sham acupuncture. Okay, let's explain this. This means using needles that don't actually penetrate the skin. They're like those retractable stage daggers they use in plays.
Right, or they place normal needles in random spots on the body that have absolutely nothing to do with traditional acupuncture meridians.
Got it. So it's the mechanical, physical version of a sugar pill.
Exactly. The physical intervention itself is biologically inert. It shouldn't do anything to alter the course of the disease. But in these studies, Kapchuk didn't just test the sham acupuncture against a no-treatment control group. He actually manipulated the behavior of the practitioners who were delivering the sham acupuncture.
So he made the doctors act differently.
Yes, he wanted to see how the human relationship itself affected the biological outcome of the patient.
According to Dietz's paper, they trained the practitioners to act in two very distinct styles. Let's break these down, because I think every single person listening has experienced both of these doctors at some point in their life.
Oh, definitely.
The first style is what the paper describes as warm and empathetic. This practitioner walks in, makes sustained eye contact, and uses patient-centered language.
They actually listen.
Right. They ask about you, your life, how your symptoms are affecting your day-to-day routine, and crucially, they project confidence in the treatment they are about to give you.
We can think of this as a high-engagement, high-ritual interaction. The practitioner is fully participating in the ceremony of care.
And then you have the second style. This practitioner is efficient, but remote. They are dismissive. They might look at their clipboard or their computer screen more than they actually look at you.
We've all had that doctor.
Oh, absolutely. They don't engage in warm small talk. They just come in, do the mechanical intervention, in this case, the sham acupuncture, and leave the room.
Now, remember the parameters of this study. The actual molecule, or in this case, the physical mechanical intervention of the sham needles, is completely identical in both scenarios.
It's the exact same physical touch.
Right. If medicine were purely about mechanics and chemistry, the outcomes for the patients should be identical.
Because the drug is the same.
Yes, but they weren't. The patients who were treated by the warm, empathetic, confident practitioner experienced a significantly larger placebo response than the patients treated by the remote practitioner.
Which means the actual physical effectiveness of a treatment changes based on how the doctor speaks to you.
It's incredible.
I want everyone listening to just reflect on their own medical experiences for a second. Think about a time you went to the doctor feeling awful. Maybe you had a terrible sinus infection or a migraine.
Just feeling miserable.
Right. Have you ever walked out of the clinic before you even got to your car to drive to the pharmacy and fill your prescription and realized you already felt a little bit better?
Like the pressure just lifted a bit.
Yeah. Your pain was a little duller. Your chest felt a little lighter. Just from the way the doctor listened to you, validated your pain, and confidently told you they had a plan.
I think most people have experienced some version of that. And traditionally, our medical culture writes that off as a psychological comfort. We say, oh, the doctor has good bedside manner. It made me feel less anxious.
Like it's a bonus, but not the treatment.
Right. We treat the bedside manner as a nice decoration around the real medicine, which we assume is the drug you pick up at the pharmacy. But Dietz's analysis of Kapchuk's work insists that we have this entirely backward. The practitioner's behavior isn't just decoration. It is a constitutive element of the treatment itself.
A constitutive element, meaning the behavior is part of what makes the medicine the medicine.
Exactly. Let's say you have a pill that reduces inflammation. Delivering that drug in a hurried, dismissive, impersonal encounter is fundamentally, biologically, a different treatment than delivering that exact same drug with warmth, empathy, and confidence.
Wait, really? The same pill becomes a different treatment?
Yes. The ritual makes the medicine. The human relationship is not separate from the therapeutic effect. It is the delivery mechanism for the therapeutic effect.
That is a staggering paradigm shift. The relationship is the medicine. But as brilliant as Kapchuk's empirical research was, Dietz points out in the text that Kapchuk eventually hit a wall.
He did. He had a massive problem.
Right. He had proven that this works. He had 30 years of rigorous clinical trial data showing that open-label placebos work, that the unconscious mind triggers healing, that the practitioner's warmth changes biological outcomes.
The data was rock solid.
But he lacked the structural, philosophical vocabulary to explain why it works. How does a warm smile and a white coat physically reduce gut inflammation? It sounds like magic.
Right. Kapchuk was a clinician and an empirical researcher. He observed the phenomenon, he designed brilliant experiments, and he proved its existence relentlessly. But he didn't have a theoretical model to explain the underlying mechanics.
He couldn't connect the dots.
He couldn't explain how an organized pattern of symbols and behaviors, which is what a ritual is, could somehow reach into the nervous system and reconfigure a person's biology.
Which is exactly the gap that C.F. Dietz's 2026 paper fills.
Yes. Dietz brings in something called the closure framework.
Okay. The closure framework. This is the heavy lifting of the paper. This is where we get into the deep structural theory. Dietz uses this framework to provide the explanation Kapchuk needed. The core concept here is something Dietz calls a cognitive closure regime.
Bit of a mouthful.
Yeah, I am going to need you to break that down for us because it sounds like incredibly dense academic jargon. What on earth is a cognitive closure regime?
It does sound dense, but it's actually a very elegant way of describing how humans make sense of the world around them. According to Dietz, a cognitive closure regime is a system that stabilizes content.
Stabilizes content. Okay.
It takes the chaotic noise of reality and organizes it into something predictable. It does this by doing three specific things. First, it draws distinctions. Second, It establishes identity criteria. And third, it maintains lawful relationships among its elements.
Okay, that's still pretty abstract. Let's map this directly to the clinic, as DXVA's in the source material. How does a normal Tuesday afternoon doctor's visit draw distinctions, establish identity criteria, and maintain lawful relationships?
Okay, so when you walk into a medical clinic, the environment immediately goes to work drawing distinctions. There is a clear distinction between the patient you, the person seeking help, and the practitioner the expert offering help.
Okay, two distinct roles.
Right. There's a distinction drawn between illness, which is why you were there, and health, which is the goal. Next, the environment establishes identity criteria through symbols.
Like the props.
Yes. Think about the stethoscope, the white coat, the medical degrees framed on the wall, even the smell of antiseptic. These aren't just objects. They are symbols that identify this specific space as a place of confidence, authority, and healing.
And what about the lawful relationships?
That refers to the sequence of events. You don't just walk into a clinic, grab a scalpel, and start operating on yourself.
Obviously not.
Right. There's a lawful, expected order to things. First, the waiting room, then the nurse takes your vitals, then the consultation, the physical exam, the diagnosis, the prescription, and finally the follow-up.
It's a very rigid script.
Yes. That sequence isn't arbitrary. It is what makes a medical encounter a medical encounter rather than a casual chat with a friend at a coffee shop.
You know, breaking down this dense concept, it reminds me of the grammar of a restaurant.
That is a great comparison.
Yeah, you don't need to read a manual to know how a restaurant works. You walk through the door and there's a host. The host seats you. A waiter gives you a menu. You order, you eat, you ask for the bill, you pay, you leave.
It's an ingrained pattern.
That sequence is the grammar of dining out. If someone walks up to you on the sidewalk, hands you a bill for $50, and asks you to pay before you've even seen a menu or eaten any food, the grammar is completely broken.
You'd be totally alarmed.
Right. You would immediately feel anxious, confused, and defensive. Your nervous system would probably go into a mild fight or flight state because the lawful relationships of the experience have been violated.
Exactly.
Your nervous system craves the correct grammar to feel safe and understand what's happening. The doctor's office is the exact same thing. Our nervous system craves the correct medical grammar to feel safe enough to drop its defenses and begin healing.
That is a brilliant translation of Dietz's concept. The grammar of the restaurant tells your brain that you are about to be fed. The grammar of the clinic tells your nervous system that you are about to be healed.
Wow.
Dietz explains that this grammar constitutes facts. It establishes structurally that this person in the white coat can help me, and this room I am sitting in is a place of recovery.
But they aren't necessarily conscious thoughts.
Crucially, no. And this connects back to Kapchuk's open-label placebo studies.
Yeah.
These don't have to be conscious beliefs. You don't have to sit on the exam table and consciously repeat to yourself, I believe this stethoscope means I will heal.
You just feel it.
They are structural realities that your nervous system recognizes intuitively, just like you intuitively recognize the sequence of ordering food at a restaurant.
So what does this all mean? We have this abstract philosophical theory of a cognitive closure regime, this grammar of healing. But how does recognizing a sequence of events actually physically alter the biology of the body?
That's the million-dollar question.
Right. How does realizing I'm in a doctor's office cure the physical inflammation in my gut if I have IBS?
To explain that leap from an abstract cognitive grammar to a physical biological response, Dietz references a study from the third paper in their series, titled The Grammar of Healing.
Hmm.
It's a fascinating study by a researcher named Benedetti regarding prefrontal damage dissociation. And this is where the mechanism, the actual how of the placebo effect becomes crystal clear.
Yes, the Benedetti study. This is where the theoretical rubber finally meets the biological road. What exactly did Benedetti find?
Benedetti looked at a very specific group of patients. These were patients who had suffered severe damage to their prefrontal cortex.
Okay, the prefrontal cortex.
Now, the prefrontal cortex is the part of the brain responsible for complex cognitive behavior, decision-making, and moderating social behavior. It's essentially the brain's executive command center, the part that understands complex rules and grammars.
So the part that understands the restaurant or the clinic.
Exactly. Benedetti found that these patients with prefrontal damage could still benefit from active painkillers. If you gave them a shot of morphine, the morphine worked perfectly well at reducing their pain.
Because the morphine is just a chemical. It binds to opioid receptors in the nervous system, regardless of what the executive command center is doing. It doesn't need permission from the prefrontal cortex to work.
Exactly. But here is the critical, mind-blowing discovery. These patients entirely lost the ability to benefit from placebos.
And completely lost it.
Yes. If you gave them a sugar pill and told them it was a powerful painkiller, absolutely nothing happened. The placebo effect vanished completely.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, what does the prefrontal cortex have to do with the grammar of a doctor's office?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it proves the biological reality of a concept Dietz calls downward causation.
Downward causation.
Yes. The prefrontal cortex is the anatomical bridge. It is the exact physical location in the brain where the cognitive closure, the recognition of the medical ritual, the white coat, the warm doctor reaches down into the biological closure of the nervous system.
It's literally a bridge connecting the two.
The prefrontal cortex recognizes the grammar of healing. It says, ah, the symbols are correct. The sequence is correct. We are in a healing environment. And once it recognizes that grammar, it initiates the downward neurochemical cascades.
What does that mean physically?
It literally sends signals down to the lower brain and the nervous system, instructing them to release endogenous opioids, to release anxiolytics, to dampen the inflammatory response.
So if the prefrontal cortex is damaged, the bridge is out.
Exactly.
The patient can still experience the ritual, they can see the doctor, they can hear the warm words, they can take the pill, but because the bridge is broken, the cognitive recognition never happens, so the signal never reaches the nervous system to trigger the biological healing.
Exactly. This proves that the placebo effect isn't just some vague, mystical, new age mind-body connection. It's a highly specific, anatomically located process of downward causation.
It's physical.
Yes, the cognitive recognition of the ritual directly causes a downward biological effect.
This completely reframes what a pill actually is. Dietz points out that in this framework, the pill is merely a ritual object.
Like a prop.
Right. It's a prop in the ceremony. It activates the grammar. The grammar is what initiates the biology. And this perfectly, beautifully explains the 2010 open-label placebo study we started with.
It brings it all full circle.
The honesty about the sugar pill doesn't break the healing sequence because the sequence relies on the grammar of the ritual, not a false conscious proposition about the pill's chemistry.
That's the breakthrough right there.
You still opened the bottle at 8 a.m. You still swallowed it with water. You still went to the doctor's office. The grammar was intact, so the prefrontal cortex still initiated the downward causation, even though you knew it was sugar.
Precisely. The conscious knowledge that the pill is sugar is completely irrelevant to the prefrontal cortex's structural recognition of the healing ritual. As long as the grammar is fulfilled, the biology follows.
Okay, this is all incredibly compelling. The data is there, spanning 30 years. The biological mechanism is there. The anatomical bridge in the brain has been identified.
It's a rock-solid case.
If the ritual is this biologically powerful, if the relationship between the doctor and the patient is literally an active medical ingredient, why does modern medicine treat it as a nuisance?
That's a great question.
Why is it treated as a confound that needs to be scrubbed out of research?
This brings us to Kapchuk's deep structural critique of the very foundation of modern medical evidence, the randomized controlled trial, or the RCT. The RCT is considered the absolute, unquestionable gold standard of medical research.
Right. If a drug isn't proven in a double-blind, randomized controlled trial, it doesn't get approved by the FDA. It doesn't get prescribed. It's the gatekeeper of all modern medicine.
To explain the problem with the RCT, Dietz borrows a concept from the philosopher of science, Nancy Cartwright. Cartwright calls things like RCTs nomological machines.
Nomological machines.
Yeah, a nomological machine is a highly controlled system designed to generate facts, but it can only do so within extremely strict operating conditions. Think of a massive factory machine designed to stamp out perfect metal gears.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
It works brilliantly, but only if you feed it the exact right type of metal at the exact right temperature under the exact right atmospheric pressure.
And anything outside of those strict operating conditions is rejected by the machine. It just spits it out.
Yes. Cartwright calls that rejected material the remainder. A nomological machine generates facts, but it also inevitably generates a remainder stuff that doesn't fit the machine's narrow parameters.
So how does that apply to the RCT?
Kapchuk argues that the RCT is a nomological machine. It is designed to isolate one specific thing and one thing only, the chemical effect of the drug. And to isolate that chemical effect, the RCT is explicitly mathematically designed to control away or subtract the therapeutic encounter effect.
So they designed the study specifically so that the ritual, the practitioner warmth, the symbols of the clinic, all of that is mathematically subtracted from the data so they can see only what the molecule itself does.
Correct. The RCT treats the human relationship, the healing grammar we've been discussing, as noise. Mm. It is treated as a confound, as the remainder.
I have to push back here on behalf of the listener because this feels like we're approaching a dangerous cliff. Are Kapchak and Dietz saying that randomized controlled trials are bad or useless?
No, not at all.
Because if we throw out the RCT, we throw out the entire mechanism that protects us from snake oil, from toxic chemicals, and from dangerous drugs. That seems like a very dangerous road to go down. Are they anti-science?
This raises an important question, and it's vital to clarify what Kapchak is actually saying. He's absolutely not saying RCTs are wrong or bad or that they should be discarded. RCTs are brilliant at doing exactly what they were designed to do, testing molecular efficacy.
Right, making sure the chemical works and is safe.
Exactly. What Kapchak and Dietz are pointing out is that relying solely on the RCT creates a massive systematic bias in all of modern medicine.
A bias toward the molecule and away from the human being.
Exactly. By treating the ritual and the relationship as mere noise to be subtracted, medicine is actively ignoring what is often the dominant therapeutic mechanism for many conditions.
Especially things like chronic pain, right?
Yes, especially conditions involving pain, fatigue, nausea, and the nervous system's regulatory capacity. Dietz has a brilliant quote in the paper that summarizes this perfectly. The remainder is not noise. It is the proof that the grammar is finite.
The remainder is not noise. Meaning that therapeutic effect that the RCT throws away into the trash bin, that's actual healing.
Yes, it is.
That's real biological reorganization happening because of the medical ritual, and we are just discarding it because it doesn't fit the machine's parameters.
We are discarding the very mechanism that humans have used to heal each other for thousands of years before pharmaceuticals even existed. The power of the shared structural grammar of a healing encounter. We spent a century trying to purify the molecule, and in the process, we've forgotten the power of the ritual.
Okay, let's synthesize this incredible journey we've just been on. We started with Ted Kapchak proving the impossible that open-label placebos, sugar pills that you consciously know are sugar pills, can significantly improve chronic severe conditions without any deception whatsoever.
A total game changer.
Yeah. He proved through fMRI that this healing trigger operates entirely unconsciously based on learned neural associations. He proved that the warmth and empathy of the practitioner physically dictates the magnitude of the biological outcome.
And then C.F. Dietz provided the unified framework. Dietz showed us that the medical ritual is a cognitive closure regime.
Right, the grammar of the clinic.
Exactly. It is a structured grammar of symbols and roles that our prefrontal cortex recognizes, which then uses downward causation to biologically alter our nervous system. The ritual isn't noise. It is a biological mechanism.
This is a total paradigm shift. I really want you, the listener, to view your next medical encounter differently. When you sit in that waiting room, when you see the doctor's white coat, when they listen to your heartbeat, when you take your medication at the exact same time every morning, I want you to realize that these aren't just decorations around the medicine.
No, they are the medicine.
They are the medicine. Your nervous system is reading that environment and using it to initiate healing. The warmth of your doctor is literally a biological intervention.
It empowers the patient and the practitioner. It means every single interaction matters. Healing isn't just about a chemical interacting with a receptor. It is a collaborative structural event.
I want to leave you with a final mind-expanding thought to mull over. If Ted Kapchak and C.F. Dietz are right, if our nervous systems have learned to trigger deep biological healing in response to the specific grammar of a medical clinic, what other grammars in our lives are secretly rewriting our biology right now?
That's a huge question.
What is the grammar of your workplace telling your nervous system? What is the grammar of your living room or your daily commute telling your biology to do entirely below your conscious awareness?
That is the ultimate question of the closure framework. We are always immersed in a grammar. The question is, what is it telling our bodies?
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.